The first case this morning is Planned Parenthood of Indiana versus the Commissioner of Indiana State Department of Health. Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. When Medicaid providers are also state grantees, and when they are also abortion providers, taxpayer funds inherently cross-subsidize abortions, even if they do not pay for them directly. By providing that abortion providers cannot be state contractors or grantees, HGA 1210 creates a qualification that protects taxpayer funds from being used to subsidize abortions, even indirectly. Planned Parenthood, in this case, seeks to enjoin enforcement of this Section 1 of HGA 1210 passed this past legislative session because it supposedly restricts patients' free choice among providers under the Medicaid Act, and they also seek to enjoin it under the DIS block grant program. But neither of these acts precludes anything that HGA 1210 does or even confers on Planned Parenthood or its co-plaintiffs a federal right that can be enforced through Section 1983. This first point is important, this lack of cause of action, and it proceeds from the structure of the Medicaid Act, which merely sets forth the conditions under which the state may receive reimbursement from the federal government for its medical care programs. Now, going as far back as Maine v. Thibodeau, where the Supreme Court first permitted statutes to be enforced through Section 1983, the court noted that there has to be a violation of a federal law before there can be any cause of action or any right to be enforced under 1983. We submit that there can be no violation of the Medicaid Act by a state because all it does is set forth the grounds under which the federal government repays the states for its medical activities or medical care program. Now, it so happens that there is a provision of the Medicaid Act that specifically confers on the Secretary of Health and Human Services the authority to deny funding to states whose programs do not adhere to those conditions or whose plans fail to meet those conditions. But it does not say that there is an independent duty on the states to provide any kind of medical plan under any particular set of restrictions. It says states can have a medical plan, and if they meet certain conditions, the federal government will pay for that. Now, Gonzaga, the most recent pronouncement, or one of the most significant recent pronouncements from the Supreme Court on the cause of action issue, speaks in terms not only of a violation, but in terms of the need for an unambiguously conferred right that has to be bestowed on a plaintiff before they have a cause of action through Section 1983. And there's nothing here that bestows any right whatsoever, much less does so unambiguously. What we have under the free choice plan provision is simply that, a plan provision that speaks in terms of permitting the choice of providers who are otherwise qualified. Now, that also brings into play Section 1396A(p)(1).
Well, before we get to that, let's stick to the text of Section 23, which is the primary focus here. And that statute is phrased in rights-granting language.
Well, no, I think it's not, in part because, specifically because there are no rights bestowed under the Medicaid Act. It is only a condition under which the state can get payment from the federal government.
Well, once the state opts into the system, the requirements of federal law have a binding effect on the state, and so they have the force of law, and you're right, the state is free to adopt or craft a non-compliant plan and put its federal funding at risk, but that, and that's the point that's made throughout the briefs and thus far in your argument, but that really answers the wrong question. The question here is not whether the state can do that and put its federal funding at risk. You're certainly free to do that, but the properly focused question here is that once the state opts into the system, is it bound by the text of the Medicaid Act, including those portions of that text which are phrased in rights-granting language in favor of the beneficiaries?
The text is not phrased in terms of right-granting language. It's phrased in terms of what the state must do if it wants to receive funds. And in fact, It's not even phrased in terms of if a state takes federal money, it must do X. It's phrased in terms of if the state wants federal money, it must do X. So understanding that construction, this is unlike any of the civil rights spending clause provisions like Title VI or Title IX that specifically refer to rights that adhere to individuals where there's a
the word individuals contained in this text?
Oh, yes, in the under 23.
What more do you want than that?
Well, I think that there's no command there for a state to do anything. It is a list of things that states can do if they want federal money. And if the state doesn't do those things, perhaps the federal government will say, okay, we're not going to pay you any of the money. But it does not independently bind states. There is no violation by the states of the Medicaid Act simply because they choose not to do what the conditions would require for federal reimbursement.
Well, it reads like a free choice mandate. Once you opt into the system and secure federal matching funds to operate the system, you are required to comply with this free choice mandate. I know that mandate is not a good word in federal health statutes these days, but that's what this reads like.
Well, no, except that it says this is what a plan has to contain, and if a plan contains these things, then the state is eligible for payment. So that's all it's talking about is what a plan has to contain. That then refers to what the federal government has to do with a plan. And under 1396C, if the plan doesn't abide by the conditions or if the state's enforcement doesn't abide by the plan, et cetera, then the federal government can say, we're not going to pay you any more money.
Right. That there's a federal government remedy here doesn't foreclose the possibility of an individual remedy.
No, I completely agree. What I'm saying is that the statute's simply not written to confer rights. It's written to say, here's what a state has to do if it wants federal money. That's not the same thing as saying if a state takes federal money, it has to do X, Y, Z. So that's the structure, I think, the overall structure under which we have to analyze 1396A-A23. It's simply not cast, certainly not unambiguously, in terms of individual rights. So 1396A-A23, aside from that, does speak in terms of qualified providers and affording free choice among qualified providers. 1396AP1, in turn, says that in addition to any other authority, a state can impose qualifications, the same qualifications that can be imposed by the secretary. But that text, in addition to any other authority, obviously presupposes that states can enforce other qualifications on providers. And that's all that we have here under this statute. To qualify to be a Medicaid provider, you can't be an abortion provider. The idea, again, is to keep taxpayer funds from indirectly subsidizing the abortions. A theory, by the way, and a notion of financial integrity that's never really been contested, I think, by the other side, in the sense that we talk about this indirect funding issue, and it's we've never said, well, no, we've never heard from Planned Parenthood, well, no, we have a particular kind of accounting system that prevents that from happening. And I think our position
is... How could you have that? I don't understand.
I'm sorry,
how could you have such an accounting system? I mean, you're asking for something that I think is impossible.
I agree. And that's why this law was important to the General Assembly, because only by separating the two can we be sure that there's no cross-subsidy. Now, the Indiana...
Of course, you don't have to take the money. That's easy to solve your problem.
Well, but the Medicaid Act specifically says, as one of the conditions of taking the money, we can set the qualifications. And that's all this is. So,
in what sense is this a qualification?
In the sense that you have to operate in a particular way in order to qualify for the money. Now, it's similar, indeed, to other kinds of qualifications other cases have permitted. For example, the Plaza Health Systems case says, well, we're going to disqualify or suspend a provider for dumping waste into the river. So other things...
Well, right, that has something to do with the quality of the medical practice. And that distinguishes it from this case. The fact that Planned Parenthood performs abortions doesn't have anything to do with the quality of the medical practice.
Well, it has to do with the financial integrity of the system, not permitting the money to go to fund the abortions. Now, the dumping of the waste...
Well, it's not akin to fraud. If by financial integrity you're trying to make a fraud based analogy.
I think financial integrity goes beyond that. Now, we have to remember the Hyde Amendment says we're not going to spend federal money for abortions except
right.
in certain circumstances.
No question, that's not going on here.
That's the problem. This is taking that to its logical extension. If since dollars are fungible, if taxpayer dollars flow into Planned Parenthood as an abortion provider, it inherently helps to fund the overhead expenses, the salaries, et cetera, that support both the Medicaid practice and the abortion practice. So the concern here is we don't want that to happen in the same way that the Hyde Amendment doesn't want direct payments for abortions. So that's the idea why this is an important qualification, because we want to separate these. We want to preserve that financial integrity.
Well, the Hyde Amendment has never been understood as a qualification-based statute or a legislation, piece of legislation. It doesn't speak to the medical qualifications or the practice-based qualifications of medical providers.
Right.
It has to do with a certain service that the federal government does not want to fund.
Right. Well, the way Indiana is carrying that out and addressing that is through a qualification, which it is entitled to do.
Well, right. Maybe I should get at this more directly. The problem I have with the state's interpretation of the phrase qualified in subsection 23 is that it's infinitely elastic. It can mean anything the state wants it to mean. Your position claims an unfettered right to exclude medical providers from the Medicaid program based on whatever the state considers to be a qualification, whether it's related to the scope of the services provided, which this one is, or something completely unrelated. You can think of all kinds of different hypotheticals that the state might want to regulate, but that have nothing to do with the medical practice, either its financial integrity, as in preventing fraud, waste, or abuse, or the quality, contextually understood, of the medical services that are rendered by the provider.
Well, I don't want to suggest that this is unfettered. I mean, certainly there are other external impositions, the Constitution, Title VI, et cetera. Now, within the framework of Medicaid, though, there is no definition of what's qualified and what's not. And the United States itself...
No, it's
going along with your position, isn't that going to allow the states? There's going to be a struggle by the providers to be designated as the only qualified provider in that state, I would think. There's going to be... You're just going to open up a struggle to be the monopolist of this money in Indiana or wherever this interpretation applies. What's the limitation on it?
Well, certainly we cannot.
You say it's not unfettered, but you haven't told us about any fetters.
Well, a couple of responses. First, even the United States, through 42 CFR 1002.2b, says that nothing contained in this section of the Medicaid Act can be constrained to limit a state's own authority to exclude an entity from Medicaid for any reason authorized by state law. So they've seen that this is a state decision. Now, beyond that, I think to the extent that we might completely eliminate all choice, that might be a different story. But here we're talking about 800 other providers, Medicaid providers, that have submitted family planning services claims in the counties where Planned Parenthood had a clinic. So we're not talking anything near a complete reduction in choice. There's still lots of choice.
Well, there isn't. That applies to this case. But I'm talking about what comes after if we adopt your view of the restriction.
Well, I think there are two ways to approach it, one of which is... is there an elimination of freedom of choice under 23? And the answer is no. There are many other providers to choose from. This is not a regulation that is even on the face of it geared at reducing patient choice. It's a regulation geared at maintaining the fiscal integrity of the program. Number two, even if there were some kind of reduction or otherwise improper elimination of patient choice, it is a qualification under P1. So even if you don't think that this falls under P1 as a qualification, I think that still doesn't deal with the argument as to whether this is something that eliminates patient choice under AA23.
Well, that reads the guarantee in Section 23 at sort of a macro level as opposed to the individual level. The way that the statute reads is that it vests the Medicaid beneficiary with the right to obtain assistance from any provider qualified to perform the service or services required. And so the fact that there are other providers available doesn't really address the right question.
Well, I think that the Brueggemann case gets at this when it says that you're not entitled to a particular provider. And even the Kelly Care case, they talk about this in terms of an individual's not entitled to a particular provider under AA23. That you do look at it at the macro level. Is the state eliminating choice in a program where it wants to focus everybody on one particularly efficient provider or something to that effect? But Kelly Care and Brueggemann both acknowledge that this is not to be understood to require that each individual gets their particular choice of provider. So that's, I think, the difference here.
Right. Those were cases based on the disqualification of a single practice, right?
Well, Kelly Care was an individual provider. I mean, it was one provider.
Right.
And it was not necessarily a P1 qualification issue, but it was an issue of saying, because this license has been suspended because this provider goes out of business doesn't mean that there's all of a sudden a problem under free choice. You have to look at it in terms of, are there other choices?
And right, and the question in both of those cases were due process questions, right? That's not what we've
got. No, I mean, I think Kelly Care gets at this under the AA23 issue as well. It's talking about it in terms of whether there's a property right, but it's also looking at it through AA23 for that purpose. And it's saying, this is not something that we look at in terms of a guarantee of all choices for all patients.
Well, right, and we can agree that the statute doesn't create a property right or liberty interest for purposes of a due process pre-termination hearing or post-termination hearing. That's a separate question from what we've got here. We've got a pretty straight-up interpretive question about what the statute means.
Well, but in Kelly Care, the court was getting at the property interest question by way of understanding the statute, what 23 means. So it was saying because 23 doesn't...
For purposes of due process analysis.
Yes, but as the first step towards due process analysis, it was saying, is there a right under 23 to have your individual provider? The answer was no. Therefore, there's no property right and no due process problem. So it did have to make that understanding, make that interpretation of 23 to get to that conclusion. And Brueggemann says, well, we're not going to require that there be a particular authority granted to build a new clinic because, again, it's the same basic understanding. You're not entitled to the provider you want. You're entitled to a choice among qualified providers. And we have not eliminated that choice. Nowhere near have we eliminated that choice in this circumstance. Now, with respect to... I'm sorry, Judge, did you have something? Oh, okay. With respect to the constitutional arguments that are being made here, this is, again, very similar to what's going on in Webster, which is a case where public hospitals were not to be used for abortions. And the court said that was fine because, again, the use of the public subsidy in that sense, a hospital, and precluding that from being used for abortions was perfectly permissible. This is not a situation where just because somebody performs an abortion in some other context, they're not allowed in a different, separate context where there's no cross-subsidy to be on a Medicaid provider. We, in fact, in Indiana, the FSSA has announced that it's going to promulgate a regulation that would even permit affiliations between Medicaid providers and abortion providers so long as there is no cross-subsidy. So this, I think, is an attempt to make sure that the statute is narrowly applied so there's no disqualification, simply as a punishment, as it were, for performing abortions in other circumstances and contexts. So I think that defeats the constitutional claim.
Going back to the private right of action question mm-hmm. that you opened with and that I think is the threshold question in the case,
sure.
You are essentially inviting us to create a circuit split with the Sixth Circuit.
Oh, with the Sixth Circuit, yes. Yeah, well, I think that's right.
What's wrong with the Sixth Circuit's decision?
Well, I think the Sixth Circuit focused too narrowly on just 23 and not on the Medicaid Act as a whole because, again, it treated the conditions for receiving federal funding as duties that are imposed once you receive federal funding. And that's not the way the Medicaid Act is structured. So I think that's sort of the inherent flaw there. I think the court also probably went too far in saying that 23 unambiguously confers a right. I mean, it certainly speaks of an individual, but it really speaks in terms of what a state has to do. And that may create an incidental benefit for an individual, but that's not the same thing as an unambiguously conferred right. But the deeper flaw, the bigger problem with that case is that it does not contemplate what I think Medicaid really is about, which is setting forth conditions for federal funding.
Wilder is still on the books.
Right.
So you've got to distinguish that Supreme Court case as well.
Well, Wilder, of course, didn't address this argument at all. So it hasn't squarely rejected this. It found one cause of action in the Boren Amendment. And then later in Gonzaga, the Supreme Court spoke of Wilder as being limited to where there is a circumstance where there is a specific monetary entitlement. Gonzaga clearly trying to cabin Wilder, narrow it down to that circumstance, which is not what we have here in any event. But even more broadly, Wilder simply does not address this question, and so I think it's still fair game. It's still an open issue.
But it does address your broader argument about spending clause statutes that are structured this way as invitations to federal state cooperative programming and that carry federal enforcement regimes that are vested in the Secretary of Health and Human Services.
I don't think it addresses that issue, and that's in part because the litigants in that case conceded that there could be a violation. They were proceeding under that assumption. They were willing to litigate the case solely on that specific text of the Boren Amendment, and they weren't making arguments about that broader structural issue. So it didn't address, it assumed some things, but it never squarely addressed the argument we're making today.
Your argument on this is fairly categorical and would run up against not just the Sixth Circuit's decision on this particular subsection of the Medicaid Act, but circuit precedent in a whole lot of other cases on other sections of the Medicaid Act that interpret similar language.
Well, I have to say, I'm not aware of any case that specifically addresses this argument. There are certainly cases where there was an assumption that there was a cause of action or there was a focus on another provision that assumed away the arguments, or at least implicitly assumed away the arguments we're making today. But I'm not aware of a case that nothing comes to mind right now where there is has been an effort to address this particular argument.
Well, am I wrong to characterize it as a categorical argument? I mean, you're basically arguing that this is a spending clause statutory scheme. The state has the right to decline to participate. It's voluntary. Once the state does participate, all it has to do is submit a plan, and there are no individual rights granted at all.
Well,
based on the structure of the statute. That's how I understand your argument. Maybe you're not making a categorical argument.
No.
You can correct me.
I think we're close there. I just want to point out it's not simply that it's a spending clause statute. You can have a spending clause statute that confers individual rights and says if you take federal dollars, you must do X or must not do X. Mm-hmm. But this is not one of those statutes. Now, is it possible that buried within the Medicaid somewhere there's a provision that is modeled differently, that sticks out and is not really part of that program? I'm not going to say I've memorized the entire Medicaid Act and can tell you that, but certainly when we're talking about the conditions for receiving federal payment, that's the structure. It's not if you take money, you must do X. It's if you want federal money, you must do X.
So it is a categorical argument to the extent that you're claiming that nothing in Section 1396A creates individual rights.
Right. That is correct.
Whether you've memorized that whole
That's a big list
multi
too.
subsection statute or not.
That's correct.
Is there any problem accounting-wise to show that it's an indirect taxpayer subsidy of abortion?
Well, we've had our expert Martin Burr look at the audited financial statements of Planned Parenthood, and he's commented in his affidavit that he doesn't see anything there that indicates some kind of segregated accounting, some kind of control function that would in any way address this issue. So I think from that standpoint, we've got, I think, first of all, to what Judge Kennedy pointed out, which is that inherently you can't ever really get that under control. You can't ever be sure. But we don't even have any signs that, Planned Parenthood has tried. And I think that, you know, that larger concern is what the General Assembly was addressing here. I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Mr. Paul?
May it please the Court. The state's initial argument that it cannot violate the Medicaid Act and the Act cannot be enforced against it flies in the face of more than 40 years of cases from the Supreme Court, this Court, and numerous other courts. After all, in 1968 in King, the Supreme Court recognized that a state may indeed violate its obligations imposed under a state plan. Those obligations can be enforced against it by recipients. That's been repeatedly reaffirmed. Wilder expressly rejects the argument the state makes here. Wilder said merely because the federal government can cut off state Medicaid monies doesn't mean that those individuals benefiting from Medicaid do not have a cause of action. Nowhere in the state's argument in its brief does it mention Congress's suitor fix, the statute it passed that emphasizes that merely because something is a state plan requirement doesn't preclude private enforcement. The question, of course, is not whether Medicaid in some generic way is enforceable by individuals who are beneficiaries, but whether this particular provision, freedom of choice, is. And you're hard-pressed to find more unambiguously creating rights language than the freedom of choice provision. After all, the U.S. Supreme Court in O'Bannon discussing this language said it gives recipients the right to choose among a range of qualified providers without government interference. Clearly, that is right-affirming, individually focused terminology, as the Court noted in Gonzaga. The right is clear. It can be judicially enforced. It has been judicially enforced in other jurisdictions, and it's a mandatory right. The real question, of course, is whether that right has been violated here, and the trial court properly found that the plaintiffs would prevail on the merits on that point. Not only from a dictionary sense is it clear that the state is going beyond qualified to perform services, going outside the scope. But remember, in this case, the state's own Medicaid agency warned the General Assembly while it was considering the law that it was violating freedom of choice. The state Medicaid agency said, and I'm quoting, "Federal law permits states to define a qualified provider, but requires that this definition is related to a provider's ability to perform a service and not what services are provided." And this, the agency noted further, "Restricting freedom of choice with respect to providers of family planning services is prohibited." After the law passed, the state sought an amendment to the state plan. The state acknowledged, look, we have a law here that puts us out of compliance with Medicaid. And the secretary properly denied that for the exact same reason noted by the state Medicaid agency. Freedom of choice allows choice of qualified providers. Now, the state argues that AP1 gives it the right to set any qualifications it wants. And that reads AP1 much too broadly. AP1 focuses on the problem that was arising because Medicaid providers had lost their licenses in one state, for instance, and went to another state and continued to be able to get Medicaid funds. And I think the legislative history said for up to 3 years in some examples. And so in emphasizing in AP1, the state has rights to set qualifications. These are qualifications related to fitness to be a Medicaid provider. Has there been fraud? Has there been self-dealing? Has there been incompetence? Have you lost your license? What the state says is, we have the right to think of things that we think are important to us. The state says repeatedly, well, the Planned Parenthood never disagreed with our claiming this is an important state interest. But the point is, it's not a relevant interest, Your Honors. What happens if next year the General Assembly says, you know, that abortion thing, a bad idea. We're going to repeal that. But what we're really concerned about in Indiana is smoking. Smoking is a particular problem in Indiana. Let's say that if you are a Medicaid pharmacy, you can't sell cigarettes. And then the next year they say, well, you know, that's not such a good idea. How about we just hit the providers? It's terrible to go into a doctor's office and see that he or she is smoking. Now, those are all arguably important government interests, but they have absolutely nothing to do with whether the person is qualified to perform the service. And if, in fact, we interpret AP1 that way, whole swaths of the Medicaid Act are read out and make no sense. Why have freedom of choice? Why have this important individual interest that the Supreme Court says guarantees that persons on Medicaid choose the providers of their choice if the state can just willy-nilly make it go away?
You acknowledge that the state's authority to determine qualifications of Medicaid providers extends beyond what would traditionally be considered licensure requirements?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a boundary. The boundary is whether it is concerns a fitness to be a Medicaid provider. And that is given, states have been given discretion, I believe, since 1978 to set reasonable qualifications by the federal government. But those qualifications have to relate to the ability to provide Medicaid. The state cited to the Plaza Health Labs case where you had the environmental dumping. But if we look at that case, we see that what the reason the person was being denied Medicaid for, being terminated from the program, was that this was deemed to be a crime relating to furnishing or billing for medical care. It was Medicaid-related. This qualification here is not Medicaid-related, and it puts at the mercy of the General Assembly the ability to obtain this type of care. And remember, the federal government pays 90% of family planning services under the Medicaid program. Again, I don't think we need to go any further than the structure of the statute, but we have an interpretation by the Secretary here, which is entitled, I think, to binding deference under Chevron. The Secretary has been given the absolute discretion by the federal government to review state plan amendments, to either deny them or approve them, and to determine if, in fact, the states are complying with the substantive requirements of the Medicaid Act. Based on this, the Secretary, who gave this initial duty to CMS, in consultation with the Secretary, the administrator of CMS, determined that the state plan amendment here violated freedom of choice for virtually the exact same reason that the state Medicaid agency said it violated freedom of choice. It went beyond the scope. It imposes something that has nothing to do with the qualification to provide Medicaid services. And that's entitled to deference. We have seven circuits already saying that approval or denial of state plans are entitled to deference.
I'm not sure that your proposed definition of fitness to be a Medicaid provider is very illuminating here. That seems to encompass what the state has done here, or arguably, because the state determines that abortion providers are unfit to be Medicaid providers.
Well, Your Honor, at some point it's circular, and I think the boundary we're talking about is, does this relate to their ability, their general ability to be a Medicaid provider in the sense of, as I said, fraud, competence, etc. Now, the notion that there is some involuntary subsidy here and that the state is doing a job of imposing requirements set through the Hyde Amendment. The way this works, Your Honor, is Planned Parenthood provides a family planning service, a pap smear, a cancer test. They bill for the service on a form provided by the state. They get reimbursed pursuant to a rate set by the state, which is less than the actual cost of providing the service. Their books are periodically looked at. They do everything they're required to do. It's not as if they are somehow surreptitiously seeking to subvert federal law. They are doing exactly what the state has told them to do on the forms prescribed by the state.
Right.
And to argue, I'm sorry.
It is theoretically possible to separate out the abortion services from the other services that Planned Parenthood provides.
Well, they are separated out in the sense that when the Planned Parenthood performs a family planning service, that's, they bill under that with the state
right.
Approved billing. Yes.
I guess I should focus the question. It's theoretically possible to create an affiliated entity that would perform abortion-related services to remove it from the rest of what Planned Parenthood does.
But when we this
and
yes,
create the kind of Chinese wall that the state is looking for here.
Well, but, Your Honor, that has really no bearing on freedom of choice, because we've mentioned Planned Parenthood throughout here, but the real plaintiffs in this case when it comes to freedom of choice are Ms. Clemens and Ms. Jackson, people who have Medicaid and want to use Planned Parenthood as their provider of choice.
Right, but that solution would not impair their freedom of choice.
No, we're not. Assuming that Planned Parenthood decides to do that, and assuming that the regulations are ever promulgated that allow that to happen. Obviously, at this point, the state announced, I believe, in June that it was intending to promulgate regulations, and there's been nothing further, and it's premature to even speculate. This is a preliminary injunction matter. The case is going back to the trial court, and things could happen.
But it is possible to create an affiliated entity that would perform the abortion-related services.
Does Planned Parenthood object to that?
Planned Parenthood doesn't know what that entails. If we look at the other cases that in the unconstitutional conditions standpoint that talk about affiliations, courts have been clear to say that it has to be something that is very easy, that is possible. The way this law is written now, it denies even an indirect subsidy. And at some point, as the court indicated, anything can be indirect subsidy. If there's a tax-exempt status to Planned Parenthood, that's an indirect subsidy. If there's a police officer who patrols in front, that's a direct indirect subsidy. So it's premature at this point to indicate how Planned Parenthood would react until we see what the state is intending to do. At this point, there's nothing Planned Parenthood can do. Without the injunction in this case, freedom of choice will be destroyed.
Well, if Planned Parenthood established subsidiary organizations that have their own corporate existence and their own physical existence and their own accounting systems, that would restore, or at least make it possible to restore, Planned Parenthood's Medicaid status with respect to everything else that the organization does.
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I can't concede that because I don't know what it's going to take. The General Assembly, as I said, was quite clear, no indirect subsidy. If you look at, for instance, in the legal services context where that has been accomplished, there's a possibility of sharing boards, I believe, and things like that. I don't know if that would be deemed to be an indirect subsidy, and Planned Parenthood would be incredibly remiss at this point to jump into something and not knowing the state's reaction, not to mention the fact that the higher the burden imposed on Planned Parenthood, the clearer that we have an unconstitutional condition here. But I think we have to look at the case as it presents itself today, especially in the context of a preliminary injunction, where we have the state pushing a definition of freedom of choice that it renders it meaningless. If you look at the Medicaid statute, Your Honor, we've cited a number of examples of waiver programs where the secretary is allowed to waive provisions of freedom of choice, although not with regard to family planning. Those are very narrow. They say you can waive only as to this or as to this. Well, the state's position is, well, we can waive everything. It makes no sense. It destroys the program, and that's the case that's before the court today. And for this reason, we think that the trial court should be affirmed and sent back to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Falk. Ms. Klein?
May it please the Court, Elisa Klein for the United States. Your Honor, if I may touch on the affiliates question, both to bring the Court up to date, the notion of affiliates was first raised by the state on June 24th, which was not only after the administrator's decision, but after the reconsideration request. It was just framed as we intend to do this thing, and the district court did not address it. We, in the brief that the state filed, not yesterday, but the day before the agency on its request for reconsideration, they advised the agency on page 7 that in light of the preliminary injunction, they were not going forward with the rulemaking. So as we understand it at this point, there is and indefinitely will not be any such regulations. But just briefly touching on the substantive point, it's difficult to imagine how this affiliates notion could alter the free choice of providers inquiry because, as Your Honor was pointing out, this particular provision, unlike lots of other provisions of the Medicaid Act, is not framed in terms of an aggregate, what's the effect on access to services, or items. It's framed as an individual right of the Medicaid recipient to obtain services from any qualified and willing provider. And so you look at it from the perspective of the women who are plaintiffs in this case. And if they are being told, you can't see your doctor anymore because he provides abortion services also in a way that's totally consistent with federal law, that is the free choice of providers problem. So she's being told, you know, it, like the affiliates, it's sort of a red herring. It does not change the fact that she's being told you can no longer see a doctor who performs abortion services. And as I understand the proposed regulations, they still embed the same indirect subsidy theory as the statute, which is you can't, you know, if you pay a salary to a doctor, money is fungible, therefore he can't provide abortion services.
You'd have to have separate professional staffs.
Exactly.
Is the point.
That's my understanding. And again, this is all hypothetical because all we have is this notice, and more recently, we're not going forward with it. So I'm speculating, but because it does build in this indirect subsidy, money is fungible is how the state is putting the point in its brief to the agency. So you'd have to have a separate staff, different doctors.
Well, even if you have a separate staff, you might have the same overhead.
Well, you could, exactly. So a separate staff would be the minimum. You would essentially have to have a separate provider, which is, of course, not what this, you know, to the extent a state has an ability to set reasonable standards relating to provider qualifications, it's not infinitely elastic, and it's never been stretched to encompass anything even remotely like the authority that the state is asserting here.
What does the pendency of this administrative review process, what effect does that have on the propriety of this case for preliminary injunctive relief?
Well, I recognize it's somewhat odd because you do have, because this provision is framed in individual rights-creating terms, there is a right to bring a 1983 action for an injunction, and that's what happened, and it was totally appropriate. The state had a number of options. The state could have said, because the plan amendment was denied, I will refrain from implementing the statute, and just proceeded through the administrative process and then petitioned for review in this court. But because the state was not prepared to say that, in fact said the opposite, said we're going forward anyway, it was entirely appropriate for the district court to issue a preliminary injunction. And again, the pace of the administrative process is largely set by the state. They have a right to proceed very quickly, but also can choose, as they've chosen here, to extend the period for briefing and hearing. And so the hearing is now set for December 15th.
Presumably, if the state wins that administrative appeal, the injunction could be lifted.
Correct. But just to be clear, they are making essentially the same argument on reconsideration as they're presenting in their briefs. And present, you know, it's not like some circumstances, there's a very fact-intensive inquiry, such as in the Douglas case in the Supreme Court, where the question was, will this 10% rate cut, or it might be 4% by now, what would be the impact at an aggregate level on the availability of providers? And then you often have a very empirical analysis. That's not the type of reconsideration petition that we have in this case. So unless the court has questions, I'll rest on our brief.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms.
If I could just ask one question, I'm sorry, before you step away, about the case that's presently before mm-hmm. the United States Supreme Court on a parallel issue about private right of action. And it's my understanding that the government has taken a position there, or taken a position in this case that is not, or does attempts not to get at cross purposes with that case, which is always a good idea. But the argument that's being made here by Planned Parenthood on the block grant issue is not an argument that the United States supports. Is that correct?
We have not addressed it, and it certainly implicates the issue that's before the Supreme Court in Douglas in a way that the free choice of providers and 1983 action does not. And just if you want a little bit more, the argument that we've made in Douglas is quite specific to the Medicaid Act, and the premise being that the provision at issue there, which is part of 1396A30A, by its terms, it's common ground that this would be it would be unworkable to try to have there are no judicially manageable standards to implement it. And in conjunction with various other factors, we have urged the Supreme Court that they should not create what we call a non-statutory cause of action. It's you know, agreed that you could not, under the Gonzaga framework, enforce that provision in a 1983 action. And so I just don't want to oversimplify our position, which is fairly tethered to the provision that's before the Supreme Court.
Right. No, I understand the complexity. But in this case, the district court did precisely that
yes,
on
I
the
mean,
block grant issue,
yes,
declared a sort of free-floating private right of action on a theory that the government rejects in the case before the Supreme Court, right?
Again, with the qualifications that I'm not sure the Solicitor General would say we reject the theory categorically, okay, as opposed to in that context. But yes, Your Honor is correct that there the issue is very similar. Thank you.
Mr. Fisher? How much time? You have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Couple of points. The first one is that under Pennhurst, if there are going to be conditions on what states do in the context of federal spending programs, they have to be clear and unambiguous. And I think the discussion that we've been having this morning about the meaning of free choice and the limits that may be on that, the meaning of qualifications, et cetera, demonstrate that there's nothing clear here, nothing certainly that would justify a preliminary injunction. And we have to bear in mind that with all of the possibilities that may happen once we promulgate the rule, there are applications of this statute that could be fully valid, even if one were to agree with Planned Parenthood's view of how the Medicaid statute should be applied. So I think that assuming that they're going to have a valid facial challenge here, which is essentially what this is about, is, I think, inconsistent with that observation. Now, with regard to the promulgation of the rule, state agencies are very concerned about what federal courts are doing and what they're saying about their area of expertise. I think there's a little gun shyness, quite candidly. But that doesn't mean that if we were to be stuck in neutral on the enforcement of the statute, with the understanding that there might be some utility to having a rule promulgated, that wouldn't happen. I can't promise that. I'm not in charge of the agency. All I'm saying is that if there were some change in circumstances, some observation that or an opinion from the court, that it's not a foregone conclusion that they would never do anything if the preliminary injunction were in place. I think in part what's going on is they see, well, the statute's been enjoined. We can't do anything to enforce it anyway, so why would we go forward at this point with the rule promulgation? But I think in terms of the parameters of what it would look like, what the obligations would be for an affiliate status that did not yield any kind of indirect subsidy, that's why you go through the rulemaking process. You want to find out what the possibilities are, what the public and experts in the field think that the ramifications of various structures are, and collect comments in that regard. So that's all still, I think, to be done down the road. Now, with regard to the final point I want to make is the suitor fix, which is not addressing the argument we're making here. And quite candidly, I think the suitor fix is difficult to understand what it's addressing. And in the blessing case, the parties mentioned the suitor fix to the court, and yet the court didn't even take that into consideration. It's unclear why, but perhaps they were trying to make sense of it and couldn't do that. But it certainly did not require, was not understood to require a cause of action in that case. But it speaks about relying on as a deciding factor where the provision sits within the Medicaid Act. And that's not our argument. Our argument is this is simply not a situation where there has been a command that states do X, Y, Z in consequence of having taken federal money. The argument is where you've got a program that says to get federal dollars, a state must do X, that does not bestow individually enforceable rights that are enforceable through Section 1983. No further questions. That's all I've got. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.